All right, so welcome once again to the Mary Haykin Dumont University here at Ashe. We're in the series on the four lenses in the Bible, and tonight is a wide lens. The wide lens meaning that particularly Ibn Ezra is looking particularly at words, their meanings, phrases, corollary uses in other languages. So they're very much linguists. Rashi also is very interested in grammar. He has a few dictionaries and grammar books that he uses from predecessors, and rarely do they make broader comments. Rashi is sometimes interested in timeline, and that's when he'll get the wider view. Ibn Ezra is sometimes interested in the connection of one passage to the next, but the Ramban goes much further in looking at things from a broader perspective. So Ramban was an incredible figure in history. I'll tell an interesting anecdote that all people who study at my yeshiva always tell, and that is, we often, our rabbi, Yeshivat Har Tzion in the Gush, was very generous with his time, and he would often have like a press conference where we could just ask him any question we wanted to. So those of us who knew him for many years had been at many of these press conferences, and one of the questions they sometimes asked him was, if you're on a desert island, that chair might be more comfortable for you. If you're on a desert island, what book would you bring with you? So everyone assumed he would say
Rambam.
The Rambam, right. The Rambam. Because the Rambam's book is all 14 volumes. It summarizes the whole Talmud. What else do you need? But he said the Ramban on Chumash. The Ramban wrote on the Torah, and he wrote on, and tonight we're talking about his commentary on the Torah. But he wrote on the Talmud as well, as we'll explain in a moment. And yet, the Rabbi Lichtenstein, who was a great Talmudist, said that the best book to have, if you only have one Jewish book, would be the Ramban on Chumash, on the Torah. Now, to understand the Ramban's, how he's sitting on the shoulders of the greats, in the Chumash, as we'll see in a moment, he sits on the shoulders of Rashi and Ibn Ezra. They did all the grunge work about the particular words. He has his own opinion about a lot of different things they said. He may disagree thousands of times, but he has their work to start off with. We'll see his attitude to them in a moment. In the Talmud, he also stands on their shoulders. He had Rashi explain what everything meant, word by word. And then he has the Tosfot, who did comparative work to him. This passage here, it says this. This passage, it said that. Well, they're from France. He's from Spain. He's from Catalonia, and so he's able to use their thinking. So by the time he comes around, he's got such a grand view of the Talmud. It's unbelievable, and the beginning of real in-depth analysis, which only the Salvatics in modern times actually fully brought out, but the kernels of it are in many commentaries, particularly Ramban, who was able to see things more conceptually, and just unbelievable what he wrote on the Talmud. And he had great students. He had three generations of students from him, like Rashi did. Rashi had six generations of grandchildren who were still writing on the Talmud. But he, Ramban, not so much children, but his students, his major student was Rashba, Rabbi Adret, Salman Adret, and his student was the Ritva and Ran and all these different rabbis you sometimes hear about. There was a chain of rabbis for at least three generations before things started falling apart in Spain. Now, last week we spoke about the Ibn Ezra, who was in southern Spain, which was taken over by the various raiders from North Africa and the Muslims. So that was a Muslim Spain, which was, again, don't think backward Taliban or something, but advanced civilization of the Arab philosophers and the Greeks who were translating the Greek works, the neoclassical kind of attitude. They were very much into language, their very grand sense of self. Rambam can't live in that world. He has to leave. It's too extreme. They don't allow Jews. He has to escape. But he's from that culture. Ibn Ezra lived there. And then we have the Ramban. The Ramban lives in a different Spain. He lives in Catalonia. Now you're hearing about Catalonia wants to break away. Well, then it was a separate country. They spoke Catalan, a little different than regular Spanish. And and he's from that community, and he creates a great chain of rabbis there, and he was from Barcelona, and they had the famous disputation, the Barcelona disputation, which maybe he, the Christians have, we have their record of it, we have our record. Christians say they won, we say we won. But then even afterwards, he felt compelled to get out of there and move to Israel. He lived in Akko. He lived in Jerusalem. He established one of the first minyans in Jerusalem after the Crusade. And he there is a shul today called Ramban Shul. It's not exactly the same as the shul he's founded, but it's close. It's close by. All right. Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you. Okay. So let's take a look at his relationship to Rashi. Rashi was born in 1040. Ibn Ezra was born in 1089, 49 years later. And Ramban was born in 1194. So 30 years after Ibn Ezra dies, he's born. So he's more of a 13th century person. That's why I said he already has the vantage point of knowing all the things that Rashi's grandchildren and everything. So he has incredible, incredible shoulders to stand on. Okay. Yes.
His birthday, it says, is 1194. And Ibn Ezra, it says, is 1089. So that's...
Yeah. So he's not going to actually interact with any of these people. He's just going to intellectually interact with them. Right. Right, he didn't have an actual relationship, but he had an intellectual relationship with Rashi and Ibn Ezra. The question is, what was that relationship, as we'll learn in a second? Because he also postdates the Rambam. The Rambam was, I think, died in around 1140. So the Rambam was a little younger than the Rashi. I wish I had the dates with me right this second. But so he's also standing on the shoulders of the Rambam. He disagrees with the Rambam and how he counts the 613 mitzvahs. So he has this wonderful relationship with all these predecessors. It's just great. So let's see what he says about, in his introduction to his commentary, what does he say about his relationship to Rashi and Ibn Ezra? Could someone please read my overly literal translation? Yes. Who would like to read? Dr. Phil?
To go out in the footsteps of the warriors in the pack, the great ones of the generations, heroes, to engage them in the thick and thin, and to write simple meanings.
Remember that from last time? Simple meanings, right? He's gonna learn all about the simple, again, by which we mean nothing but simple, but we mean the best straight reading. Go ahead.
And simple meanings in the verses and the Rashi, the mitzvah and the Agada.
The Agada meaning the story part of the Talmud. Go ahead.
And I will place as a lamp the lights of the holy menorah, the commentaries of Rabbi Shlomo Rashi, as a crown of glory. Paraphrase from Isaiah.
Now, I mentioned the paraphrase because it's important to understand, to know a little bit about the writings of the Ramban. Ramban is so dripping with knowledge of the biblical text, like a, you know, he could win the Bible contest, you know, with his eyes closed, right? That when he writes, it's almost disturbing how many citations he has on every page from his Hebrew is just rife with all these citations. There's just two examples of it here in this paragraph. But he can't help using phrases. Many people say that it creates a clunky sentences, but nonetheless, it's very impressive that if you look in the Chevelle edition, for instance, they have one section of the commentary where it's just all the citations on that page. And every page there's like 20 citations on each paragraph of how many paraphrases he has from the Bible. Continue.
Crowned with the ways of the text and the Mishnah and Gemara. To him is the right of the firstborn.
Now this is a slight to the Ibn Ezra. We know that Ibn Ezra was not a scholar of the Mishnah and the Talmud. He knew stuff like you and I know stuff, but he didn't. He wasn't a scholar of the Talmud. He wasn't part of the discussion about the Talmud. Okay, Rashi, Rambam, Tosfot. These people are part of an international, intergenerational discussion about the Talmud. Ibn Ezra is not. He's just a biblical commentator. So he says Rashi is the crown. Because after all, he knows his crown includes the crown of Tanakh, Mishnah, and Gemara, as opposed to Ibn Ezra, who's an ignoramus, but as far as he's concerned, as far as the go ahead.
Do you think it might be because he wasn't a rabbi?
And essentially, he's not a rabbi, right? It's the same thing. Right? Go ahead.
In his words will I meditate. In their love will in their love in will I grow.
Yeah, again, it's a citation from the Friday night psalm about the righteous will grow and continue.
And with them we will have a give and take, an investigation and interrogation.
Right, no, I'm not gonna agree with everything I say, but I'm gonna have a conversation with everything Rashi had to say, because I love it so much. Terrific. He's the king. Go ahead.
In his simple meanings and in his midrashim and agada mentioned in his comment.
Right, so I'm going to have a discussion about all this stuff. Go ahead.
And with Abraham Ibn Ezra, we will have an outward rebuke and a hidden love.
Right, now this is a very mysterious thing to say, because what's this hidden love? If you're rebuking him and you say that, oh, tis, you shouldn't say these radical things, that certain lines in the Talmud and the Torah are really written later, and all kinds of weird things that he said, and he rejects certain rabbinic things. Why do you have a hidden love for this person? So,
was that a rhetorical question?
Meant, go ahead. Yes, go ahead.
If it's applied to modern academics, if you love someone who's interested and cares enough to go into the depths of the study that you're studying, whatever that may be, even though you disagree with his findings,
right,
you still love him.
Yes.
Place of life.
As Ben Gurion said about Rabbi Maimon, most annoying person I ever knew, but I love him so much. Right. Good. Now, so understanding that, good, so that's his relationship. Since we're studying these other characters, I thought we should know the relationship between the three, and that basically builds his commentary on, I'm going to discuss the Rashi, I may say something respectful, not respectful about it, what he says, move on to the Ibn Ezra, I'll be more likely to say something disrespectful about what he says. Now, notice he doesn't mention the Rambam here. It could be the later stage of his commentary. He commented more of the Rambam. Probably there were different stages of his writing. I'm not so familiar with all these academic discussions. But sometimes he takes on the Rambam in the Guide to Reflex. As, you know, Rambam makes a lot of things into metaphors and dreams. And he didn't like that so much either. Although in general, the Ramban's relationship with the Rambam is as follows. People in the Ramban's times, there was a Maimonidean controversy, various stages of it. During his life, they said they should ban all the Rambam's writings. He said, no. We'll ban as far as his legal writings, it's gold. We study that. As far as his philosophical writings, we're not going to ban that either, but you can't study until you're older. You have to study Talmud first, and then only then the philosophical writings. So he made a compromise, and that was generally his role. Very often, Rambam would say it's a Torah law. Other people would say it's a rabbinic law. And he would say, part of it's a Torah law, part of it's rabbinic. He often was the middleman between many disputes. Those are men of peace between them. However, one noted exception, he has a book taking on the Provençal community, who had their own community with their own rabbis for generations. And they attacked an Andalusian rabbi named the Rif, Rabbi Isaac Alfasi, and his summary of the Talmud. Ramban writes a book called The Battles of God, and he rips the man to shreds. He says, that is wind, that is foolish, that is nobody who... He says the cruelest thing. But in his commentary here, he's very genteel, and he nicely deals with Ibn Ezra and how he disagrees, and that even the Rambam, and he disagrees nicely with his three major friends. Okay, so let's get to the topic of the wide lens. So first look, we're going to look through the books. Our first job is to look at how he has a wide lens on the different books. As we mentioned, Rashi is a little more primitive in his commentary. He doesn't have an academic introduction. Ibn Ezra and the Ramban do. And we're going to rely heavily tonight on the introduction of the Ramban to the different books. And we'll look at what he has to say, his wide view of the books. He has a view about the books of the Torah and what they have to say. Each book is a separate book, and how the things hang together. Our first citation is not from an introduction, but it's rather from one of the commentaries on the passage. The long passage, I'll try not to comment. Let's just read that first passage. Who would like to read it for us? Let's see. Larissa, would you do it? Let's hear and read all that.
And Abram passed through the land unto the place of Shechem. I will tell you a general principle. Understand it in all of the coming sections about Abraham, Yitzhak, and Yaakov. And it's a great matter. Our rabbis mentioned it in a brief way and said, everything that occurred to our forefathers is a sign for the children. and therefore the verses will write at length in recounting the journeys and the digging of the wells and other events. And one who thinks about them can think as if they were superfluous things with no purpose. But all of the events came to teach about the future, for when an event occurs to a prophet, meaning of the three forefathers, he will contemplate from it the matter that is decreed to come to his seed, and know about every decree of the wakeful ones, that when it goes from a potential decree to a symbolic action, the decree will be realized no matter what. And therefore the prophets will do actions and prophecies, like the statement of Yirmiyahu that commanded to Baruch, "And it shall be that when you finish to read the words of the book, you shall throw it into the Euphrates, and you shall say, so will Babylonia sink." And so too with the matter of Elisha and the placing of his forearm on the bow. And Elisha said, "Shoot," and he shot. And he said, "It is the arrow of salvation of the Lord and the arrow of salvation from Aram." And therefore the Holy One, blessed be He, kept Avraham in the land of Israel and did to him simulations of all the future that would be done to his seed. And understand this, and I am now beginning to explain the matters in detail in the verses with the help of God. And Avram passed through the land unto the place of Shechem. It is the city of Shechem that is the name of that place. And Shechem, the son of Hamor, was named after the name of the town. And Rashi wrote, "He entered it unto the place of Shechem to pray for the sons of Yaakov when they would come from the field, anguished." And this is correct.
He agrees with Rashi.
And I would add that Avraham held this place first, and before he gave him the land, it was thus hinted to him from this that his children would conquer this place first before they would merit the land, and before the iniquity of the dweller of the land was complete to exile him from there. And therefore it stated, "And the Canaanite was then in the land." And when the Holy One, blessed be He, gave him the land in a statement, then he traveled from there and planted his tent between Beit El and Ai, since it is the place that Yehoshua conquered first.
Okay. So, what's this comparison with other prophets? As he sees the stories of Genesis in light of what we find in other books of prophecy. When a prophet has a prophecy, how does it very often start off?
The Lord said.
True. But sometimes he'll give him a sign. He'll say, like, we have Hanukkah coming up. So the prophet says to Zechariah, "What do you see?" He says, "I don't know, I see a menorah." And there are two olives on it, and there are olive trees on the other side. So he's, "Oh, that's the two sons of the Yitzhar, the Kohen, and this is the Jews, and this is by the spirit and not by the sword." And so very often prophets are given physical things, and they're told what will be. Here he's claiming that the same thing here. The prophets are told, the prophets dig wells. So you say, ho-hum, it doesn't need to be in the Bible, it's not important. They dug a well, who cares? He says, no. That means something. I'm not here to, I have to check what the Ramban says about that. But there's some, it's as if the God said, dig a well. And he dug a well, and God says, that well means such and such. And now he says, Avram passed by Shechem. What do we care where he went? Let him go here, there. No, he went to the places that will be conquered first by Joshua. So their whole life is a symbol. However, now, if their life is a symbol, so we run into a problem. As a matter of fact, he says here that whatever it is, it must be. He says, where does he say that? Did you see that? Whatever is must become, must be.
The decree will be realized no matter what.
Good. Now, this is a big debate among modern religious Zionists today, right? In other words, we say, well, God prophesied He'd bring the Jews back to Israel. So He did. And now we have to march forward towards redemption unabated. And we can never give back land. We can never move backwards. We can only move forward. And we will move forward because that's what it says. Or do you say, no, that prophecies can sort of move around and sometimes they don't get fulfilled because we're not worthy of it. And so it's a big debate. Here he's taking position that whatever was prophesied must come true. Certain fatalism. So does that mean, is Avraham having a real life or only a symbolic life? It sounds like it's just symbolic, but of course, whenever there's a two-sided question, both sides must be correct. So will you read for us this other comment on the bottom of page 2? Gio, will you read that for us?
There was a
famine in the land. Abraham went down to Egypt to live there and save his life. And the Egyptians took advantage of him, and the Holy One, blessed be He, took revenge with great plagues. And they went out with gold and silver and encouraged them to leave. Not one thing was missing that would not take place among the children.
So obviously, this part of Abraham's life is a symbol of what? It's a prefiguring, as the Christians say, it's a prefiguring of what?
The slavery in Egypt.
Slavery in Egypt and going out with great wealth. Okay. Continue. Maybe. Let's see. One second, I have a little overlap here. One second. Just continue on the next page, and it is a hint.
Abraham.
And there was famine.
And it is a hint. I want you to skip a little bit. Go to the line that begins with the word men. And on that line it says, and it is a hint. Right here.
Skip down to here in this paragraph.
Go ahead.
It begins with the word men or and.
And.
And it is a hint.
Yes.
And it is a hint from Abraham. Since his children went down to Egypt because of hunger, to live temporarily in the land. And the Egyptians did evil to them and took their wives, as it says. And every baby girl you shall let live, and the Holy One
if God kills all the males and male people, what's going to happen to all the girls? We know. What's going to happen to the girls? Yeah. So taking Sarah is like saying, let me kill all the boys and the girls. Yeah. They'll remain. Right, we know what's going to happen to them. Go ahead.
And the Holy One of Blessing avenged them with great afflictions until they were taken out, laden with silver and gold, sheep and cattle, with many possessions. And they, the Egyptians, pressed them to be gone from the land. Not a single incident that befell the father didn't befall the children. And this matter is explained in Bereishit Rabbah 8:6. Rabbi Pinchas said, in the name of Rabbi Oshaya, the Holy One said to Abraham, go and conquer the way for your children. And you find that everything that was written regarding Abraham was also written regarding his descendants. Regarding Abraham, it is written that there was famine, and there was famine in the land. Regarding Israel, it is written, this is already 2 years of famine in all the land.
Okay, so far, everything he does is just symbolic of what will be. Continue. Dr. Joe, want to continue?
Thank you.
Yes, go ahead.
No, and you should know.
And you should know that our father Abraham committed a great sin unintentionally, in which he brought his righteous wife to stumble into transgression because of his fear of being killed. And you should have trusted the name to save them. Shouldn't have left Egypt to begin with.
He's getting it.
His wife and all that was his, because God has the power to help and to save. And going out from the land which had been commanded at the beginning, due to a famine which was transgression which he committed, because God would have saved him from dying even in a famine. And because this deed was decreed that his seat would be an exile in Egypt under the hand of Pharaoh.
Right. So on the one hand, his whole life is symbolic. Whatever happens to him is going to happen to the Jews, because he's just a symbol. He's a living prophet, not a prophet, but a prophecy. His whole life is one big menorah, a symbol of things to come. On the other hand, sometimes he botches up like the best of them, but even that botching up, that where he take my wife, please. He took that literally, right? And he leaves Israel. He just got to Israel. There's a famine. He goes down. He said, "What are you? I told you to go to Israel. What are you going down to Egypt for? You want to go to Egypt? You're going to Egypt." So even when he makes a mistake, that itself becomes the future. If you ask the Rambam, why were the Jews slaves in Egypt for 400 years? Because they were like us. He didn't stay in Israel. Right?
To me, that's very important, because otherwise you're reading this as a history book. You're not connected to it. If you're looking at this as a foreshadowing of some kind, then you are connected to it. You're a part of it.
Right, but the danger is that if it's just a foreshadowing book, then he's not a real character. And the beauty is, Ramban is able to see, right? It was very radical for him to do that. You see why he likes Ibn Ezra, secretly. He's willing to say that the forefathers sinned. Today, you say this in the yeshiva, they'll throw you out. They don't like this type of thing. This is not popular. Everyone studies Ramban. No one doesn't like Ramban, but they'll de-emphasize this. It's kind of, oh, he didn't really. It says he sinned, but you know, when they say that he sinned, it's not like when you and I sin. This is different. That they'll try to somehow cover up, because there's different traditions of how to study. I don't mean to make light of it. There's a tradition that when you study the Bible, you don't make fun of any of the characters. You don't try to find any faults in the character. They're holy. They're a little less than an angel, etc. There's another way of studying the Bible, which Ramban was very much a proponent of, and that's why Rabbi Lichtenstein was very much a student of that, and his whole yeshiva, all the stuff on the books and the internet coming out from my yeshiva, from the Magid Press, it's these wonderful articles about Tanakh. It all very much comes from the school that says human beings, flawed individuals. Moshe Lichtenstein, the rabbi's son, wrote a book about Moses as a very flawed character. So the Ramban does, to some degree, a literary analysis. He takes the characters literally. I mean, he takes them as fully fleshed out, real characters, not caricatures. And yet, he's also a mystic. Don't think he's not a religious, right? These paragraphs are dripping with all his religiosity. He says, with God's help, and he also. He believes this, right, that these stories that happened to him, it's going to happen to them. He's a huge believer, but he's very lax about criticizing the forefathers. He finds sins in all these things. Afflicting Hagar, that's why we suffer from the Arabs to this day. We afflicted Hagar. Shouldn't have done it. I mean, he sees these people as real characters. Notice the length of the commentary as we're reading this week. This is much longer. He is someone who's fully, he's writing in fully excursive form. Right? It's a full, the rhetoric is complete. Some of it, he were lectures. He gave a lot of public lectures. Rashi, you have a sense that, you know, he just wants to get you through the page of Talmud and next, you know. Whereas these are more like lectures. And because he's standing on the shoulders of others, He swats away all the opinions. He said, let's say, look at Rashi. This is why I don't agree with that. Ibn Ezra, this is why I don't agree with that. Rambam, I agree with that. And that is what I do agree with, and this is the mystical aspect. It's very organized. It's a lot of arguments. Amazing. So, how does he view the characters? Are they just symbols? Are they real? Gio is correct. It's both. It's amazing. Let's continue. Exodus introduction. Now, what about his larger view of the Exodus? Exodus is a strange book. If you think about it, it doesn't hold together. You've got the Exodus story. We call it Exodus. When did that come? I don't know exactly. But it's similar to a rabbinic name called the Sefer Geulah, the Book of Redemption. So if you think about it, even if you look at movies that try to pretend to be movies of the Exodus, they don't know when to end. You end with the splitting of the sea. Do you end with, I don't know, what else, going out of Egypt, right? So there are different ways of doing it. Some of these movies, they conflate going out of Egypt with the splitting of the sea, like it was one big thing. Ten Commandments, the Cecil DeMille, that they said, put the Ten Commandments at the end. They called it the Ten Commandments. So that's the peak. But we know the Ten Commandments are in chapter 20. There are 33 chapters, something like that. So there's all these things about the tabernacle. So what does that got to do with the book? Why is that an appropriate conclusion to the Exodus story? The guys who make the movies, they have no idea. Right? But the Ramban has an idea. So there's a wider lens. We're going to look at the whole book, and he's going to tell us all about it. Let's read that. Who would like to read that? Warren, would you read that for us?
The exile is not complete until we return to the land and to the spiritual level of their forefathers. Now, when they left Egypt, even though they had left the house of slavery, they were still considered to be in a state of exile. But they were in a foreign land, wandering in the wilderness. However, when they reached Mount Sinai and set up the Mishkan, and God returned to them, establishing establishing the Shekinah among them, then they returned to the spiritual level of their forefathers, i.e., the presence of God upon their tents, and then they were considered to be redeemed.
So we ask, why is it called the Book of Redemption? So we think, we read the movie, saw the movie, read the book, we think it's because they were redeemed from Egypt. He says, you know what they were when they got out of Egypt? Yeah, goldish, right? They're nothing. They were still the same no good nicks who were slaves. Because we know from Ezekiel that they were sinners, they were idol worshippers, etc. But you know when they achieved the status of Avraham, Yitzchak, when the Jews in Egypt achieved the status of Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, whose achievement was? What was their crowning achievement? That God was with them. Mystically speaking, and the Ramban is a mystic, he predates not by much the coming out of the Zohar. So he's a mystic, but he doesn't use the Zohar because there is no Zohar. But he's got all this mystical tradition. He doesn't spell it out. He alludes, he believes that mysticism is for the few. So the mystical layer of his commentary is written cryptically, and there's still not a layman's guide to what in the world he's talking about when he talks mystically. But he is a mystic, and mystically speaking, the very simple mystical, well-known mystical tradition that the forefathers were the chariot for God. What is a chariot? Something God sits on, meaning He rests on. They were the people that God rested with. So the goal is to return to the level of your forefathers. It's an expressive verse, Malada Watam Yashuvu, to return to the level of your forefathers. So when will they return to the level of the forefathers? When God rested them. When did God rest on the Jews? Two places. Where?
Sinai
and the Mishkan. So why does the book end in the Mishkan? And with God resting in the Mishkan? Because then, at that point, they are redeemed. The Book of Redemption comes to an end. The Exodus comes to, they're really out. Yes?
In the first song, he says, return to their land.
Oh, right. 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 There's a very anti-Zionistic point here. Right? See, the problem is, the book ends, that's why the movie makers are in trouble. You can end it, you know, looking, you know, the book of Deuteronomy ends with himself looking out toward the promised land. That's a nice movie ending, it's a nice picture. But this book ends, they got a tabernacle. Right, but if you understand what Israel is, what is Israel? Right, there's an element of that. But we talk about the Aliyah L'Rego, all the Jews going up for the three festival pilgrimages, and everyone's together. There's an element of that. That if you're not in Israel, you're not part of the nation. But in this discussion, you know what Israel is?
Inheritance.
True. Again, what do we say? What were the forefathers?
A chariot
of God. When they stood at Sinai, they were the chariots of God. What is Israel? It's the place where God rests. Right? Jacob, and he was with his father-in-law. I mean, the best he had was a dream about some sheep. Okay, but he comes back. He sees camps of angels. He's got dreams of the angels are going up and down. Right. As long as he's in Israel, the angels are all over the place. It's a place of the resting place of Shekhinah. So, but you're right, there's a problem because the book ends and it has nothing to do with Israel. As a matter of fact, they're on their way, but it doesn't, they're not a very Zionistic ending. They're marching with that tabernacle in the center of their camp to move forward toward Israel. It's true, but. So it's a very spiritual kind of a book where it ends on the spiritual note. That forget Israel. That's not the important thing is that the Jews are centered around what would be Jerusalem one day, but what would be the temple. They're centered around the temple. They built it, and God rests among them. And that's it. And you're really there. Now we just need to establish that permanently. It's moving. It's a temporary. It's a show on the road. We got to get it into a home. And that's what David does. He hammers it down into Jerusalem, and then that's it. But we're spiritually we're there, but on a permanent basis we're not there. We're traveling, but everything has poles. It's on the move. It's on the run.
This is when they become the chariot to bring Shekhinah back into the land of Israel.
Oh, good. That's interesting. Great. And the whole question is, does the land make them holy? Is it the land makes them holy, or that they make them? Right? God makes it holy. Is it inherently holy? Moving along. Introduction to Exodus. Leviticus. Leviticus, we've got a similar broad lens problem. Broad lens problem is, the first many chapters are talking about Levitical matters. The rabbis call it Torat Kohanim, the laws of the Kohanim. Levites, Kohanim, same thing. It's Levitical, not in the sense of the tribe of Levi, Levitical in terms of like clergy. Okay? But that's good until you get to Parshat Kedoshim, which is about love your neighbor as yourself. It's a lot of chapter 19 is largely about interpersonal stuff. It doesn't seem to be a Levitical book. It's also holidays. There's stuff in there that doesn't seem so Levitical. So he's got a broad lens problem. What is the book of Leviticus? So let's see. We have the chair raised.
Okay. Most parshiyot in this book speak with the Kohanim. Speak to Aharon and his sons. Command Aharon and his sons.
Right, that's how you usually start the section. God said, speak to Aharon and his sons. Go on.
And in Parshat Kedoshim,
that's chapter 19, that's where it says, love your neighbors yourself. Go ahead.
Some mitzvot to the sons of Israel, most connected to the matters of sacrifice or the like.
So he claims that if you look through, you see, we like to think that chapter 19, love your neighbors yourself chapter, has got all these wonderful, mushy kind of things, but the truth is, there's a little bit about sacrifices that are brought on the wrong day. There's a mixture, intermingling of interpersonal and sacrificial things you give to Levi. So there is an element of that there. That's his excuse. But go on.
And God wanted to warn them about impurity, as it says at the end, and warn the children of Israel about impurity, which defiles my sanctuary.
So it's important to talk about impurity, because impurity defiles the sanctuary. Go ahead.
And it brings us to warn them about immorality, for it's impure, and its sins are called impurity, which caused the divine presence to leave.
So the parsha of Kedoshim, you should be holy, and love your neighbor as yourself, and don't put a stumbling block before the blind, and what else is there, chapter 19? All beautiful concepts. Don't lie, what else? All the beautiful ideas there. Don't afflict the stranger, and all these things. But that's the... You should be holy, and right next to that it says don't sleep with your sister, and you know, all sorts of incest and all sorts of things you shouldn't do, which make us defiled. And if you're defiled, then you can't go into the sanctuary, and you can't be a holy camp, and then you can't have the divine presence. So it goes a little bit back to the things we were talking about last time in the last book. But so he tries to connect it all together. Here's some effort to connect. Okay. Introduction to the Book of Numbers. What is the Book of Numbers? Most people don't have a good knowledge of what the Book of Numbers is, because what is it? So give us a little overview here. Let's take a look. Let's see. Let me just move this chair over for a second. Dr. Phil or Barbara, would you like to read that for us about the introduction to Numbers?
And this book is all mitzvot, which are temporal, which they were commanded as they stood in the desert, and the miracles which happened to them, to tell all that God wondrously, and he told how they began to take their enemies and commanded them to divide the land for them.
Right. So it's temporal. Now, it's about the Jews in the desert. So he told them, you have to line up like this. There's no permanent mitzvah for Jews to line up in a particular formation. But in the desert, he told them, you have to line up in this formation. And so he says some of the things are temporal. What else? And then other things that happened in this temporal setting, and there were many miracles as well. So it seems that he wants to put like the rebellion of Korah in the framework of miracles that happened. You see, I would describe the Book of Numbers as, it's a book about the Jews who were supposed to go to Israel, but they did so many sins, like the spies, like Korah, like the complainers, that they, like Miriam slandering, that they got stuck in the desert, and they wandered around until they finally started conquering, and things turned around a little bit. He's saying, let's not look at it so negatively. It's not about how the Jews did all these sins. It's about all the wonders of how God dealt with this. Right? They complained, so he gave them the man and the slough from the heaven.
Miriam talks slanderously, so she got leprosy. They rebelled against Moses, so they
what happened? The earth swallowed them up. So he claims the book of miracles. You can take it or leave it. This is his view of the book of Numbers. Let's see. Did you finish? And there are not lost?
After they were told to divide the land.
You go ahead.
After they were told to divide the land, he commanded the sacrifices be done in the land. In the desert, they did not offer musafim, for they were not commanded in libations in the desert, and as they came to the land, they have to bring the daily and musaf offering.
So those of you who are not so interested in details might find this tedious, but that there's a strange thing. In the book of Numbers, we have all the offerings of the holidays. You'll notice any time there's a special holiday, we always read from the book of Numbers, chapter 28, what's the offering, how many sheep, how many cows, etc. But what does that got to do with a book about traveling in the desert? He says, these laws are told right before they come to Israel. Again, the end of the book of Numbers is right before they go to Israel. Because you don't bring sacrifices in the desert, because sacrifices include meal offerings and libations of wine. How much meal offering and how much wine do you have in Israel, in the desert? So all the sacrifices are brought only after the desert is over. So that's a radical idea that there were no sacrifices in the desert. They didn't have a daily sacrifice in the desert. They had it at Sinai. Anyway, but that's the big picture. Similarly, I'll just read briefly an introduction to Deuteronomy, give his view on Deuteronomy. This book is known, which Moses will explain to those who come to the land, most of the mitzvot they need in the land, and will not mention matters of Kohanim. So we've got a big problem. You know the modern critics who say that there's J and P and all that. So they say, well, there's nothing, there's no P, there's no Levitical stuff in Deuteronomy, so it must be the Deuteronomist. You know, it's different. So he was aware of this problem, but there was very little Levitical stuff in Deuteronomy. So I'll tell you why. The Kohanim are very zealous, they don't need warnings. Before they come to Israel, he's like, oh, these tribes, they're going to sin, you're all going to worship idols. So he starts warning them, do this, do that, don't do this, don't do that. But the Levites, he leaves them alone. He's not worried about them. They never worshipped idols. They're not going to worship idols. So that's his answer. And first he rebuked them for their sins in the desert, and how God was merciful with them. They should not return to their sinfulness, and show them that God will always act mercifully with them, so no one should say, I cannot inherit the land, for I am a sinner. So we show them that God is merciful, as it says, and with you is forgiveness, so God will be feared. We say this in Psalm 130. We say, when someone is sick, we read Psalm 130, Shir HaMaalot. And it says there's something we don't always think about. And he gives a good interpretation here. With you is forgiveness, so you should be feared. Doesn't make sense. If God would not forgive me, then I would fear him. But if God forgives me, why should I fear him? I have to worry, he's a nice old man, he never punishes me anyway. No. When you see how he forgives you, you're overwhelmed with thanksgiving, and wow, he didn't kill me, and then you fear God more. So, the book tells us how you were rotten, you Jews in the desert, you sinned at the golden calf, you sinned with the spies, but the book is not there to rebuke. Rashi says the whole book is a bunch of rebuke. He says, no, the opposite. The book is about how wonderful God is. He didn't destroy us. And he's not going to destroy you. In the land of Israel, you're going to go to Israel, and even if you sin, you're not going to be destroyed. Even though sometimes we get the impression that the Torah says, if you sin, you'll be destroyed. But there is another, there are two ideas. For instance, the book of Kings is very clear that when the Jews sinned, they were not destroyed. And that's the message. You're going to go to Israel, and of course you're going to sin, but you're not going to be destroyed. Because I didn't destroy you when you did the golden calf. I didn't destroy you with the spies. And so it's a book of God's mercy. Rashi, in his introduction to the first verse, in the explanation of the first verse, says, oh, the whole book is rebuke. Everything's a rebuke. It's all about rebuke. You know, it's like a man who's dying, and he gives his son what for before he dies. And I think Ramban is taking a different view, much kinder view, that no, the book is about the mercy of God in the face of sinfulness.
The Kohanim that we know of, Simeon, Korach, Nadav, Abihu, are destroyed.
Right, so he doesn't have to talk to them, right? The bad ones are... Very good, excellent. All right, let's see. I'm going to come back to the big concepts later, in a second. But first, I wanted to show you a really interesting thing about the meta structure. We've got a huge problem. Going back to Genesis, we've got a huge problem. The problem is that we believe that God gave the Torah to Moses. Moses gave the Torah to the Jews. You read Genesis, who's missing in Genesis? Moses. Moses should be telling the story, and God, right, it should say, and God said unto Moses, saying, in the beginning there was God created the heaven and the earth. And then God said to Moses, saying, and then I told Abraham, we don't find, now again, right, he's right, if you're a modern critic, I'm sure you're all over this question, right? You're like, this book doesn't have anything to do with Moses. This is ancient folklore before Moses. So how does the Ramban, as a traditional and yet very, you know, critical with a small c, a kind of a person, how does he deal with that? So let's see what he says about, in his introduction to Genesis, what does he say about this? Nancy, what do you read?
It should have said
at the outset of the Torah, and God spoke to Moses all these things, saying, but it was written plain, for it did not want to write of Moshe our teacher as if he speaks for himself, like other prophets such as Jeremiah. And the word of God was to me, and in Ezekiel always God spoke.
Right. So that would sort of diminish Moses' stature if we always had to say, and God spoke to Moses, saying, no, we're going to tell the book in a different way. Go ahead.
But Moshe wrote the history of all the early generations and his own lineage as in third person, as if he spoke for third person. And for this reason, he is not mentioned until he is born. And it is mentioned as if someone else is talking to Moshe and telling about him. And the reason for the writing of the Torah in this way is that it preceded the creation of the world and certainly Moshe's birth. So Moshe is like a scribe who copies from an old book and writes, and that is why he is written without his name for it, without his name, for it was already written on a dark fire and a white fire.
Yes, this is a wonderful midrash.
A wonderful midrash that the Torah is written black fire and white fire. In other words, there's an ethereal Torah. It doesn't have all the physicality of this book about oxen and all the physical things we have. There's an ethereal Torah that the angels wanted to have. It's the disembodied, you know, wisdom of the Torah that predates the world by gazillions of years. And therefore, of course it doesn't say God spoke to Moses, because as if to say, this story didn't begin with Moses, not because God told the story to Moses. The story was out there, you know, before Moses. It was always out there. Even before Abraham was born, it was out there. Because it's the eternal Torah.
It would probably say Moses not human.
Ah, very good. It would put him at the all-knowing author. Right. God is the all-knowing author. Not right. Although it's not written, it's interesting, the Torah is not written from the perspective of God. He doesn't deal with that problem. Why isn't the Torah written, and I say, in the beginning, I created the problem, right? But he is not addressing that here. Yeah, Lenny has an interpretation of this. You heard once, I forget. But what would you say? What's the mystical meaning of the idea that the Torah is written on black fire or on white fire? What's the idea?
That there is meaning in the space between the letters.
That's good. That's good. The space in between the letters. That there's right. We're going to get to that in a second if we get to it. About the Ramban's view of the there's more than what's written. Right? As if you're a true believer and you believe that the Torah is just this incredible word of God, there's much more to it than a bunch of stories about some people. Okay, so where do we get to that? So if the paper in between has meaning, you just have to be able to read the paper without the writing. It's much more meaningful. It's good. So this is a very meta, you see how that's a wide lens question. You know, why is Moses born, and who wrote that? And, you know, so he answers all these questions. It's not just a Genesis question, it's an Exodus question. It's an every book question. Okay. More broadly, what is the point of the Torah? All right, so this is a big one. It's a long one. Page 7. Let's just give a little background, because this is not the whole passage. Again, the Ramban is very lengthy. Spanish commentators tend to be very lengthy. Abraham Brunel is the most famous for being extremely lengthy. There's a midrash that says that the Torah should have started with Exodus 12, the first laws of Passover, because that's the first time there are laws. So Rashi says very simplistically, he just quotes the passage, and sort of in a simple way, well, we wanted to tell the Goyim that God made the world and give it to, he can give Israel to the Jews, and don't say that we stole the land. Because so that's why the story is written. That's what Rashi says, and based on that, Larissa, would you read that for us? Would you mind reading that big passage?
In the beginning, God created. Rabbi Yitzhak said the Torah should not have begun except from "This month is for you," Exodus 12, which is the first commandment that Israel was commanded. And what is the reason that it opened with "in the beginning"? So that if the nations of the world would say, "You are thieves, since you conquered for yourselves the lands of the seven nations," they would respond to them, "All the earth is the Holy One's, blessed be He. He gave it to whomever it was fit in His eyes. And by His will He gave it to him, and by His will He took it from them and gave it to us. And this is the tale in the words that our Rabbi Shlomo wrote in his commentaries. And one can question it, because there is great need to begin the Torah with, "In the beginning God created," for it is the root of faith. And one who doesn't believe this and believes that the world is primordial is an apostate and has no Torah.
There's a great medieval debate. Do we accept Greek philosophy, which says that there is a helio or something like that that predates the world, as a pre-existing substance was always there, God didn't create it, and it coexists with God forever? Or do we say that God created everything from nothing? So almost all Jewish philosophers reject this Greek idea. Ralbag and a few others accept it. The Ramban, as you see here, vociferously rejects that idea. And he says, it's a very important way. He says, I don't understand. Where did you get this legalistic view of the Torah that it's only here to give you laws of paschal lambs? The Torah is therefore to tell you about creation and beliefs. So here already you see Ramban, the abyssal philosopher, more of a philosopher, Rashi, the technocrat, relatively speaking. Again, Rashi, as we said, he's all about meaning. But in a sense, Rashi, the Talmud is saying, I can skip all these stories. I just want to get to the laws, what to do. The Ramban says, well, of course, you can't say that, because I'm also a mystic. Go on.
It is because the work of creation, it's a deep secret. It's not intelligible from the verses, and it will not be understood by its students except through the received tradition up until Moses, our master, from the mouth of God. The strength, and those who know it are required to hide it. Therefore, Rabbi Isaac said the beginning of the Torah doesn't require "in the beginning God created," and the story of what was created on the first day, and what was done on the second day, and the remaining days, and the lengthy telling of the creation of Adam and Eve and their sin and punishment, and the story of the Garden of Eden and Adam's exile from it, for all this cannot be understood with full understanding from the text.
Okay, so this is another radical idea, and it stems from his being a mystic. He agrees with Rashi, actually, that the Torah is not coming to tell us what happened on the first day and the second day. Because it doesn't make sense that the sun, there was light before there was a sun. And he says, we have no idea. In other words, all these things are just mystical secrets. The Torah is just one big mystical secret. So this totally debunks anybody who thinks that the Torah has a different view than science about... The Torah has no view that we... is an unintelligible view about how the world was created. That's what he would say. It does not tell us in a way that most of us can understand how the world was created. It's only about great mysteries that only great mystics can learn, and we're not great mystics, so we're never going to know. So then what's the point of telling these stories which we can't understand? That's the question that Rashi should have explained, not the simple Midrash that Rashi quotes. See, Rashi just quotes the Midrash. The Ramban is trying to have a sophisticated view of this Midrash. And he's saying, that of course there's great mystical meaning, but since it's only mystical meaning and most people don't understand it, what's the point? Okay, go ahead. So in other words, for Ramban, the purpose of the Torah is mystical secrets, or to give us general beliefs about God. It has more of a philosophical, not just to tell us what to do. So Rashi has a more halachic view of the Torah, the Ramban has a more philosophical view of the Torah.
Go ahead.
For there is not great need of them, and it would be sufficient for the people of the Torah without these texts, and they would believe in the general information that was mentioned to them in the Ten Commandments. For in 6 days God created the heavens and earth, the sea and all that contain, and he rested on the seventh day, and the knowledge will remain to the few individuals among them as a law given to Moses from Sinai, along with the oral law.
Now, when we talk about, since he's a mystic, he reads the Torah at different levels. One level, he's with Rashi, he's in the trenches with Rashi and Ibn Ezra. What do these words mean and all that? But because he never skips the details, he's not a mystic who skips the details. Right? He's in the details. He's a Talmudist. There's no sense of his being a. With Rambam, you wonder, is he trying to like stomp out Talmudic study by writing it all in one book, or is he the ultimate Talmudist because he knows everything? Right? No one could possibly spend that much time studying it all if you didn't think it was very important. But you wonder. People have wondered historically, whether we wonder or not. But with Ramban, there's no question. I mean, he's a Talmudist. I mean, you just read any page of his commentary. He loves it, you know. But he's also a philosopher and he's also a mystic. So he's just so many different things. He's linguistic, his Hebrew is incredible. He's also living in Israel, says that that side. He has debates with Christians. I mean, he's a historical figure who we have records about. I mean, he's so much. He's just such a towering and beloved figure. Now, when we talk about a wide lens for a mystic, how wide is it? Gio, would you read that for us on page 8?
The tradition of proof, Kabbalah, that all of the Torah is names of the Holy One, blessed be He. For the words can be divided to names as if the sentence Bereshit in the beginning can be broken to other words, and so the whole Torah, aside from the connection of words and their gematrias, as in the head Berosh it bara Elohim instead of Bereshit bara Elohim.
I broke it down for you. Even if your Hebrew is not so good, you can see it graphically. You see, the third line of Hebrew says what it says in the Torah: Bereshit bara Elohim. Okay. Now move the words around. Move the letters around. Berosh it bara Elohim. What it means, I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I saw on one website, a heretical website, they said, you know, God is born in the head. You know, but anyway, I mean, who knows? I don't know what it means. I saw in the art school, they wanted to clean it up, so they said, Berosh it bara El Hayam. I take the word Elohim, break it into two words. In the beginning, God created the sea, or something like that. But the point is that the way we read the Torah could be, this is a mystical idea, it's not the Ramban's idea, that you could, the Hasidim love this, by the way, it can be moved around in different ways. It's a wonderful idea that again, that there's so much more than meets the eye. If you wonder, okay, I read the Torah, it's a very nice storybook, Shkoyach, well, wonderful, congratulations, very nice, nice book, give me another book. But if you say that the reading we have, that's just the first layer. You could, when we really figure it out in the end of days, we're going to read it in a completely different way, and we're going to find out all these other secrets that are there. It's unbelievable, right? You have these modern people who are trying to, Isha Torah, you know, they're trying to move it around and make the great, you know, move the letters and line everything up in different columns. And who knows? Maybe that could be true too. Maybe you could line the Torah up, let's say, every 16 layer words, and then 16 letters, 16 letters, 16 letters, and then and make columns and move them across. Oh, who knows? Maybe there would be support for that. But by the way, this is an attack against Ibn Ezra, because Ibn Ezra believes you can't do this meaningfully because, as the rabbis admit, very often we're not sure whether to spell things with a yud or a vav. In Hebrew, you can pronounce things e without a yud or with a yud. You can pronounce things u or o with a vav or without a vav. And sometimes we say that our spellings in our current Torahs, we're not sure of some of the vavs in the yud. It's the only thing we're not sure about. Everything else, we got it down. one hay and olive, right? But otherwise, but he says, no, we can break it down. No problem. So that's reading with a very wide lens. This is different than anything we talked about tonight. There's a whole other lens. There's a mystical lens on the Bible that's completely different, but the idea is that the whole Torah is the word, is the name of God. Going back to that mystical idea that we want to be recipients of the God's presence, right? Receptacles, chariots of God's presence. The Torah is God. It's the word, it's the names of God. It's the whole thing, the names of God. So it's not just a storybook or a law book. So that's a very wide lens. Okay. But, moving back to the Ramban and the wide lens, I think there's another aspect of the wide lens I think we need to discuss back on page five. The Ramban is very much aware of the idea of big concepts. You know, Rashi, based on the Midrash and Rabbi Akiva, Rashi quotes Rabbi Akiva, he says, love your neighbor as yourself. Rashi says, this is a great principle in the Torah. Which is not only a quote from Rabbi Akiva, but it's Rashi talking, saying, I agree. This is a great principle in the Torah. But that's a Midrash. If you're a teacher, and many yeshiva teachers say this, they say, what are the yesodot? What are the foundational principles of everything? So the Ramban has a few foundational principles, and he calls them inyan gadol. It's a big inyan. It's a great idea. It's an important concept. So I googled it within the Ramban. I have the computer capability with the Bar Ilan project to search the whole Ramban. Anyways, I found he said it at least twice. He has sometimes at least ideas of big concepts in the Bible. So one of them, the most famous. So I'm giving you two here. This is less famous, Deuteronomy 6, and then we'll turn to. I didn't have a chance to put the other one in, but the one in Leviticus is more famous. Let's take a look. Who would like to read that for us? Any volunteers? Deb, you want to read 5 for us? Page 5? Big concepts?
Yes. And do right and good in the eyes of the Lord.
Okay, so we're explaining the verse that says, the Torah says, and do right and good in the eyes of the Lord. Ramban believes that this is a very important sentence. Continue.
The contextual meaning of this verse is keep God's commandments, testimonies, and laws, and prepare them to do what is good and right in God's eyes alone. And for it may go well with you, Deuteronomy 6:18, it is a promise. It says that by doing what is right and good, that by doing what is good in God's eyes, it will be good for you. Because God brings what is good to those who are good and right in their hearts. And our rabbis in the beautiful Midrash.
Yeah, so the first level, before we get to the rabbis, the first level of the meaning is that you should simply do the commandment. God, in Deuteronomy, Moses says over and again, do the commandment. And this time, instead of saying do the commandment, he says do that which is good in the eyes of God. Which means, do the commandment. This is the simple level of reading. But the rabbi said,
And our rabbis in the beautiful Midrash said, this refers to a compromise, acting beyond the strict demands of the law. And the intention of this is that from the beginning, God said to keep God's commandments, testimonies, and laws as God has commanded them. And now it says, even regarding what God did not command, pay attention to do what is good and right in God's eye, because God loves goodness and righteousness. And it is an important concept, because it is impossible to mention in the Torah what should be everyone's conduct with their neighbors and friends in any business matter and regarding ordinances of any town or country, because the Torah already mentions many of these laws, such as do not gossip from Leviticus, you shall not take vengeance or bear a grudge, you shall not stand idly by the blood of your neighbor.
Those are all from the famous chapter 19, love your neighbor as yourself chapter. Continue.
You shall not insult the deaf. You shall rise before the aged.
All Leviticus 19. Continue.
Etc. Once more for emphasis. Generally, one should do what is good and right regarding everything, including compromise, acting beyond the strict demands of the law. Other examples of that can be found in rabbinic literature, like what was mentioned regarding the law of one whose field borders the field of his neighbor.
Yeah, Talmud says there was a fellow who sold his property. Then, I had a property and I had a neighbor. Then I decided to sell my property. So you have to, first of all, give first rights to your neighbor for him to buy it, so you can have two adjacent fields instead of selling it to some other person who's going to be running around from somewhere else and have two separate fields. So it's just the right thing to do. It's a good thing to do. Even though you may say, I like that neighbor, or why should he have such a big field, or he's going to be too big a businessman, right? It's going to be good for him. It's the right thing to do. Continue.
And even what they said regarding the depiction of the worthy prayer leader, and his youth was becoming, and he is humble and accepted by the people. And he does not speak pleasantly with other people until one reads about all matters of honesty and integrity.
I believe what he's saying there is that that when the rabbis talk about, you know, who should be the chazan or the lead the services, so they're saying, well, he should be humble, and he should have a becoming youth. In other words, he shouldn't have a bad reputation. He should speak pleasantly with other people. Where did they get these laws from? Where did it say in the Torah you should speak pleasantly with other people? He said, well, it's all part of doing what's good in the eyes of God. So Ramban views his role as commentator not simply to, you know, what does this verse mean, what does that verse mean, but to underscore certain verses as major principles and to fill in the blanks where the Torah doesn't come in. And this is very similar to the Ramban, which I think, my vacation plans changed. I didn't have a chance to put in the most obvious Ramban on Leviticus 19, where Ramban says that it says, and you shall be holy. So most people say it, take it as a throwaway verse. It's like, yeah, but get to the main point. How should you be holy? Well, don't do this, do that, do the other thing. He says, no, it's not a throwaway verse. This is a major principle in the Torah that you might think that you could, you know, follow all the commandments, and then you go home and you have 16 wives and you have 20 steaks for dinner and you do a lot of burping and stuff, and you'll be a wonderful Jew. You daven and you bring the sacrifices and you have the holidays. He said, and then you'll curse all day. Doesn't say you have to use beautiful language. Doesn't say. He says, no. He says, be holy. That covers anything that might be unsightly or unseemly. So again, the broader lens, he sees overarching and underlying principles. Rabbi Lichtenstein once gave a lecture. I can't reconstruct it, but he says there's be holy and do that which is right in the eyes of God. One of them is the overarching principle. One of them is underlying principle of the whole Torah. I don't know which one is which, but it's you get the idea that he's trying to think more broadly, to see the bigger picture than just this verse, that verse, and the next verse. And I believe this one might, maybe I'm stretching, could be connected to this idea of having a wider lens. Frankly, when the first two lectures I gave you of Rashi and Ibn Ezra, I found scholars who took this view that the essential idea of Rashi is that he's trying to give meaningful teachings, the lens of meaning. I found people who said that Ibn Ezra was seeking truth. In studying for this lecture about the Ramban, it was obvious to me that one of the features of Ramban is a wider lens. And I found, you'll see in a moment, I have this last name by Dr. Avigal Rock, who teaches at different places in Israel, Bar Ilan, the Gush Etzion. Who makes this point about the Ramban having a broader picture. But not everyone sees that as the salient feature of the Ramban. But I think it's an important point, and it's certainly something that Rabbi Lichtenstein, who was a big Ramban fan, emphasized, was the significance of Ramban. The Ramban as seeing the characters as very human. Ramban as having these overarching principles. The Ramban is having a broader view of the text. But I want to connect these dots, saying that there's an overarching principle, I think is similar
And it's part of the same idea of having to be able to look at a book as a whole. I think there's an overlap there. I have to do some more thinking about it. You can think about it yourselves.
Rabbi, can I ask you about this? What do you mean? What is it about compromise?
Oh, yes. If there are laws about oxen goring people or goring oxen, there are laws, and the rabbis interpret them, and if your ox gores my ox, there are rules of how it should be done. Some of the rabbis said, not everybody agreed, some of the rabbis said, you know, before we get to court, it's better we should compromise. But that's not the truth. The truth is we'll go to court, we'll tell our case, the judges will judge according to the Torah, we'll be in great shape. We'll follow the Torah. Isn't that what we're supposed to do? So some people say, no, Yikova Haaretz Adin, better to be like Aaron. Just get everyone together and kumbaya and split the money. And split it. It's not truth. He says, no, that's more important. You should live harmoniously and don't go to court all the time. So the laws themselves are not the ultimate. The ultimate is living in harmony. They're meta values, meta concepts. And this has become a very popular thing among liberal circles. Are there meta concepts? Again, not to group Rabbi Lichtenstein in the ultra-liberal circles, but Rabbi Lichtenstein was also very intrigued by this question of these meta concepts. Can we bring them into the discussion of laws? And you can find. I gave a class a few years ago, I think, on Shavuot about meta concepts. You can find here and there where a decisor of Jewish law will say, okay, here are the 50 different sources to answer this question. We can discuss them and which way they lean and what the answer to this question is. And also have to bring in some meta concepts to shore up all of our evidence. But there are big concepts which have to be brought into the picture as well. So being holy, doing what's right. Let's see. I didn't translate this, an important secret. So sometimes his inyan gadol, sometimes this broad concept, is some sort of mystical idea. I'm not sure exactly what he's referring to here, but no doubt something, there are also mystical meta-concepts as well. So he addresses so many of these broad concepts. What's the point of the whole Torah to begin with? Why is it structured the way it is? Why doesn't it say God spoke unto Moses? And very wide lens. Finally, if we look at a little summary that Dr. Avigail Rock wrote, I think we'll get a good summary of what I said, and we see someone else other than myself who thinks that this is a salient point within the writings of the Ramban. So, Doctor, would you finish up for us? Dr. Avigail Rock.
Viewing two examples, one can observe that the Ramban...
It is
a wide-ranging comprehensive commentary in which the Ramban uses specific verses as jumping board to general topics.
Yeah, so she thinks that his commentary is not just about details and words, but he uses a jumping board to discuss broader concepts and how they appear throughout the entire Tanakh. You notice how he brought in Jeremiah and Ezekiel. Again, the man who has the Tanakh at his fingertips, everything is all connected. Continue.
By reviewing two examples, one can observe that
I'm not giving you the examples, but this is just something she wrote. Go ahead.
It is commentary to a lone verse. One may relate many facets of exegetical, halachic, and philosophical issues. He seeks an explanation which...
So again, exegetical, that's stuff that Ibn Ezra and Rashi do. Right. What does it mean? Halachic, right? This is a Ramban. He's a halachic giant. The Rabbi Lichtenstein can take this book on an island, and there's a lot of halachic stuff he'll learn from there because this is a Torah giant. Philosophical issue. Right, he's not a small-minded man. He's good. He's got big philosophical issues on his mind. Go ahead.
And he seeks an explanation which drives through the details of many wider contexts.
Ah, so he's a man of details. He's a man who says, "How do the details fit in the big picture?" Continue.
The proof is not logical.
Local,
but wide-ranging, comprehensive, taking a broad perspective. One may also see the analytical style constructed in which the Ramban, in an organized, consistent way, lays out the issues, brings different opinions, and deals with them until it develops his own view.
So, I think Dr. Rock agrees that the Ramban has a much wider view. Israel, take care of your name. And that he's coming armed with every field of Jewish endeavor, Jewish scholarly endeavor. He's got it all, and with all that horsepower. He's giving a very wide view, and is able to comment much more broadly. Of course, he can only do that after Rashi Ibn Ezra wrote, you know, in the case of Rashi, very solid commentary. In the case of Ibn Ezra, a half decent commentary. And with that as a backdrop, he can launch into the broader concepts, as he does in the Talmud as well. Those who study analytics of the Talmud will say that, and I think Rabbi Lichtenstein is one of the people who said this, that a lot of the modern analytics of the Salvagic family, etc., have roots in Ramban, who even in the Talmud as well, since he already saw all the dialectics and all the details and all that, and standing up on the shoulders of these giants before him, was able to really cut to some much broader concepts. So the Ramban, if you hadn't appreciated it until now, is really one of the great giants ever. And one of the things that he adds is a broader lens, a wider lens. Questions or comments?
Well, what is the point of Torah? I can take you back 1,000 years, but two of my favorites, Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Yishmael. And Rabbi Akiva, as I understand it, says the purpose of Torah is to glorify God. And Rabbi Yishmael says the purpose is to refine human character. And to me, those are the two views of the point of Torah. I don't know which one is right, or both are right. But to me, it's a different time and a different view. But am I confused on this?
Right. What's in other words, about the Ramban is that on the one hand, the Torah is a mystical book which contains all these secrets, nothing to do with interpersonal relations, right. And it's also this book that has all these meta concepts of how to relate to everybody, down to the finest detail of local municipal laws,
right.
Because it gives you the major principles by which to make those municipal laws.
Yeah, if you look at
Bereshit, but there's no way you can lay them all out.
Yeah. If you look at Bereshit, that's the purpose of to live for God's glory. Otherwise, we don't know. Reshit bar Elohim. Why do we need to know?
Right, Genesis.
So glorify God. On the other hand, when you get to the Levitical code, purpose refined human character.
Well, in the 19th century, the Tzitzit claimed that the Genesis was a book of the righteous, the straight one. That the book, starting with Abraham, certainly it's about how to live a straight life. So that the Genesis is very much about ethical principles. Or the breach thereof. I'd have to get into more deeply with you about the Rabbi Shmuel or Rabbi Akiva, but yeah, certainly some rabbis will certainly lean more toward the interpersonal, toward the mystical. Yeah, but I think what's beautiful about the Rambans we saw today, these comments we saw today, is I think the melding of the two. Any other comments? Thanks for joining us. Next week, we're going to skip many, many centuries and go to one of my favorite commentators, and that's the Sfat HaMet. He's more of a preacher, mystic, Hasidic Rebbe. Also has a lot to say about the simple meaning of the text. And we're going to look at two aspects of his commentary. One is the lens of association, that through associating one idea with another, we can get to some new ideas. We'll see what we can do with that. And that's my idea. And then something else I saw others wrote about, and that is goes back to our first idea, reading the Torah in a way that the lens of personal meaning, even more than Rashi trying to preach different meanings, now sort of using the Torah text to sort of, in a more micro kind of way, to guide my life, and to see the text as speaking to me and how I should worship God. So we'll see that, God willing, next week.
Thank you.